data, tracking data as well.
That's right. We've surveyed them and asked them about their cows, and the top three issues that come back from the survey, I wanted to see that carcass data to see how I compared it to the national average beef quality audit. Second one is I wanted to use that data to see if I did need to make a genetic change in my cow. And Bill, I'll tell you, after 5 or 6 years of doing this, what are we seeing? Quality grades are going down. It's just there. And this last year is just shocking, the number of field grade fours that we had in the program. Just almost doubled this last year, which tells me a little bit maybe about the feeding sector as well as genetics. The last thing that they have used the information for, which surprised me, and I don't think I'd ever recommended this, Tom, was to get rid of those non-productive cows. Instead of making maybe a bull change to see if that would help first, they actually got rid of some non-productive cows. They were being able to individually ID animals or trace that calf from the packing plant, feed on back to that cow and take a load. This is not a threat.
Good point. The opportunities, I think, that you have that are not perhaps dollar obvious when you get involved in Alliance are the ability to institute management programs perhaps that you haven't put in the past or that you weren't able to in the past. And just what John said is really important, that when you become involved in some of these programs and you're able to find that cow that's been eating your grass but not doing her job, and you can let her go to town, the result in profitability to your operation is dramatic. And some of those kind of things come as a side benefit. They probably don't go to a bottom line analysis when you're doing a cash flow statement, but they're there. They're part of what happens when these kind of things come along. We've talked about what to look for. We've talked about how to stack up, what sort of things to look for. What are some of the pitfalls that we need to be aware of, that people need to avoid? What are some of the potholes in the road out there? Ken?
One thing I'd like to get is the natural programs. I think Tom was very good about bringing the point. The other point is they're really pushing the natural. A lot of these producers are out there and saying, oh, you know, there's $80 premiums on the natural thing. The thing that we're finding is switching to the natural program, those cattle are already lined up at least 6 months in advance. And I'm getting a lot of guys calling me and saying, hey, I've got these natural cattle ready to kill. There's no place to kill. And I'm going ahead and putting them through my grid with no natural program. And whether it's Coleman or any of these, if you're going to get into a natural program, you better have the cattle locked in on the marketing thing and not just get them all natural. But I'm ready to send them to town, they're going to bring natural premiums. And they talk about how much this natural thing is growing, but it's still a very small niche market as far as the total cattle industry is going. And if it's 1% of the market, they say it's doubling. Well, you're doubling to 2% of the market, which still means it's very limited. So I think you need to really investigate the marketing of these natural cattle and get them locked in before you go to all the expense and trouble of doing it and then have to kill them like regular cattle. No time comes.
The man who broke me into the cattle business told me one time when I was trying to lobby him to feed some kind of off-speed cattle that I thought were a bargain. He said, in deals like that, you go sell them first, and then you go find them and produce them. When you get the sale done, then come back and talk to me, and we'll go find them and we'll put them together. And I think that's a wise thing that everyone should keep in mind. Patsy?
Bill, one comment related to that. When you think you've found your market and that retailer, do your due diligence, and when you think you've done enough, do some more. Because if they go away on you and you've got this much money invested, this much lost production cost, and that retailer goes away on you at the end of the program, then you're shoved back into a commodity market. Even when you market them into natural programs, it's tough to break even with just conventional management programs. When you're put in that situation, it will take you out. So do your due diligence and do some more. And make sure you know who you're working with.
I can put a big amen to that one. I've I can show you some of my personal scar tissue about dealing with retailers over the years. Go ahead, Don.
I think that the parking operator, in fact, it's a lot easier for him to take out of my hat than it is the retailer's hat. And I think they're a lot tougher bargaining than the time. So if anybody's going to give, it's going to be on my side of the table.
You're dealing with him once a year. They deal with the retailer every day and have an ongoing relationship that they've got to nurture. And so it's just in the nature of the system, the beast that we're a part of here. John, in Montana, as you've worked through these programs, you've spent a lot of time. I know your people have spent a lot of time on the road in feed yards and in backgrounds trying to get that data so to flow back to your guys. What's been your experience there? Have you been largely successful? Has it been a tough road to hoe? What's been the cooperative kind of aspect that you've seen?
Let me stand here so I can see this part of the audience.
Yeah.
There's disappointments, terrible disappointments out there because they have lost the identity of these cattle, Bill. And be honest with you, these tags get cut out either primarily in the feed yard. And there's a lot of reasons for that. They don't want to maybe share data or that. We've had very few problems with packers in this country allowing us to put somebody in there to get the carcass data back. My favorite story about the 200,000 head that we've tracked has been that we had worked for 2 years to get some genetic data, and the cattle were killed in Schuyler, Nebraska. They had 4 ear tags in their ears. One was an electronic tag and 3 panel tags. And the grader, or the guy who put the carcass data collector, said, John, there is no tags in any of these heifers that we've worked 2 years. They had all been cut out. I'm just devastated. And so I called Jerry Lipsky at Semitas and said, Jerry, what are we going to do? He said, don't worry, just go in there and take a little piece of meat. DNA will be able to track them back for you. Don't worry about it. So that was on Friday. Monday I called Mark and I said, Mark, did you get the meat samples for us out of the parts that we lost before tags? Absolutely. Put them in a bag and just like you said. And he said, I put them in the freezer, but I have a problem. Oh my God, what happened? He said, well, my freezer was full at home, so I took them over and I put them in my mother's freezer. And Mom has Alzheimer's disease. And I said, oh, God, what happened? She said she thought it was stew meat, so she cooked all your samples. Afternoon, and I picked him to Montana in the pickup, and I got run off in the ditch, and I am just swearing at him. How could we have lost 2 years' worth of data? And it got quiet on the phone. I said, are you still there? And he said, yeah, just joking. So cutting the tags out has by far been our biggest frustration, and the guy didn't get his data back after he did better with us.
We've had all kinds of issues come along, and Warren Weiber, I remember back in the winter of 91 when we did Strategic Alliances, one of the learnings that the producers in that group had, we went to large ranches and we asked them to take the middle of their steer calf crop and visually sort those calves for uniformity and send us one truckload up. And we had 15 producers do that, and they went to Decatur County Feed Yard with Warren. And then we did something really insidious when they got there. We individually weighed them off the truck and then sent the weights back to the ranchers, thinking that that would be of value. We got some really nasty phone calls. I don't know what in the hell kind of scales you guys use, but I have sorted cattle my whole life, and there ain't 350-pound range in something I've sorted for uniformity. And that was just the beginning of the learnings in that program. And when they began to really look at individual data as they moved through the system, I think there was a dramatic learning curve that everyone goes through when they first are given availability of that kind of data. And so these kind of things are all part of the system here, and they're all part of what we're trying to get done. As we look at the retail side, and there's been a lot of comments today about the retail side of things. Tom, how much influence on what the real target is has the retailer been in your particular alliance? have they pretty much dictated what they wanted, or have they said, okay, if you've got this, then we'll get along here? What's that inner reaction that you've had between the retail and the Alliance?
Well, there have been some give and take, but I think when we set out and said, okay, here's what this product needs to be, we've stuck pretty true to this. There's been a little bit of give on carcass weight. Initially, we had some pretty tight specs on carcass weight. And there's been a little easing of that. But as far as the quality grades and yield grades and tenderness issues, we stuck pretty close to what our vision was for that product. Because when you verify something which is done on a routine basis for this product, it has to perform. And when it doesn't, we hear about it.
And you were really cutting new ground when you did that with that tenant's claim on a particular brand in terms of standing behind it. And I would imagine that shook up some of your members in order to be able to deal with all
that. It did. And I went back and looked at some tenants data the other night and looking over about a 3-year period. And what had to happen is that we had to have a different kind of capital to get things where they needed to be, because we got out of bounds on some capital. And it required that you had to look pretty hard at the kind of cattle we're putting in. And you know, our specs say that they cannot be more than half continental. We'd like them to be at least half British. And hump height is an issue, so not much Brahmin influence in the cattle, if any. And so all those issues come to play. And I think that we found that when you went out and sourcing these cattle, you wanted to buy some of these continental crosses that would really perform in the big market for you. But yet some of those cattle were having trouble staying in bounds and some of this other these other specs. So it required that you rethink the kind of cattle you're going to put in the program.
As we go along here, Patsy, have you seen the people that you deal with supplying their heifers, and I know that you're also involved in some feeding alliances as well. Have you seen the change in the kind of cattle that you're seeing come through that program in terms of, we're talking frame, muscle, final weights, those kind of things? Have you seen that change over the years?
Well, the primary change that we've seen has already been talked about, and that's the cattle have gotten off the straight bread. And I guess it's like anything, Bill, you get something up, and certainly when you go to a straight bread, you're going to gain some consistencies. Meeting the grid, Ken, as you talked about, what you're going to give up are some of those production efficiencies, such as reproduction. And I will guarantee you, I mean, our yard is filled with largely straight black cattle, largely commercial cattle. And it's much harder today to get a 90-91% preg rate after a 45-day AI season than it was year 1, 2, 3, 4. And I hate to tell you that. You know, I really hate to tell you that, but the reality is it's there. And it's largely due to straight bred cattle. We need to get back to some hybrid vigor in our nation's commercial cow herd. If people don't take anything out of this today other than that point, I think we've been a success here today because it's huge. And I think what's happened, let's go back prior to our program, which started in 1990, but I think what happened is crossbreeding got a bad rap in the 70s and 80s because, number one, those of us in academia put a program out that in theory sounded good, but in reality was difficult if not impossible to manage on ranch with pasture groups and management and so on and so forth. So when people got discouraged with that, then what they went to was the next bad breed that came down the pike, to where people ended up with just a mongrelized cow herd that they had no idea what they had. And so there was a knee-jerk reaction to that, I think, in the early 90s through where we're at today in 2007. Okay, I'm not going to go down that road again. We're going to go completely away from crossbreeding, and we're going to go to a straight bred so I know what I've got. And in fact, we've taken it too far, and now we've lost production efficiencies, fertility being primarily number one. And Tom, the only thing I would disagree with your ratio is that I'd probably put a 6 or 7 or 8 on fertility in terms of economic impact to a rancher, to a commercial cattleman. So the change that we've seen is more straight bred cattle, and I don't think it's necessarily been for the positive.
In terms of the variations within breeds, of course, we've got a lot of information today that we didn't used to have with EPDs and so on. And we can strike out inside of breed and make some pretty dramatic changes in cattle we want to produce without getting outside of those bounds. Do you see many producers doing that now, Patsy? Are you seeing, or are you, Tom, seeing producers try to do that, to step out into trade leaders and various different kinds of traits that they're trying to aim for?
I would say the answer to that is yes, Bill. I think we've got some very advanced producers that know and understand EPDs, know and understand genetic information, and are doing a nice job of that, and trying to do that to the best of their abilities. Some of our breed bases have gotten pretty narrow in terms of AI sires out there. It's getting harder and harder and harder to do as we move through this thing. So we've got people who are working at it. Are they as successful at it as they'd like to be? I'd say the answer to that is probably no, because they've got some constraints they're working with. Tom, I don't know if you agree with that or not.
I did. You said it exactly right. Even though I struggle to find those sires that are balanced, that can produce cattle that work on the value-based system, cattle that do have growth, get cattle that don't sacrifice the maternal effects that I need in that cow herd. And you can find those, but as you said, Patsy, it gets harder to find all the time that you've got the balance in.
And I might add one thing to that, Bill. When we select service sires for our customers' heifers, first of all, our customers are very involved in that decision. But when we provide input, which is about 95% of the time, what we do, the way we select service sires, is that we find a pool of bulls that meet our production requirements first. Okay, then those are the cattle that we work from. Then from that pool, we'll sift cattle out based on carcass traits. Don't go the other way. Find the cattle that work from a production standpoint, your growth figures, those kinds of things that will work within windows of acceptability for your particular feed resource environment. And then from that pool of bulls, start sifting the no-loads, if you will, from a carcass standpoint. Pretty soon you've got yourself down to two or three or four pretty good sire choices that you take to that rancher then and say, okay, you know, here's a bull that's going to work in your environment, produce the kind of cattle that you stated in your goals or what you're trying to do, and you can meet some of those goals in that manner. But I think where people make a mistake is sometimes they're chasing this carcass thing in front of production, and that's going to get them in trouble.
John, what's your experience in terms of the advice that you're being asked for in extension? Are you being asked for that similar kind of advice, or what are the people in Montana asking you to help them with in terms of
Well, I don't think they ask me for any advice on genetics. We're in a pretty interesting state with the kind of genetics that we have in there. We've got fairly large breeders in that. But I guess listening to these comments here, I'd like to ask Patsy and Pop a question about hybrid bulls. I mean, you said black. If you want to maintain consistency, let me use a hybrid bull. Yes or no? Give me your opinion on that.
You know what, John? You had a young man on your program at the Montana Nutrition Conference last spring that I thought did a nice job of talking about composite bulls. And it was one of the young Sheeplebine boys, which they are involved in composites a lot. And I'm going to credit this statement to him, but he talked about that composites are nothing more than a Betty Crocker cake mix. You know, you go back to the old days and, you know, cake mixes probably didn't stack up to a cake made from scratch in the kitchen. Over the course of time, they've gotten better to the point that you can produce a cake mix cake in the kitchen, just add water and stir. And you don't have all the work and all the ingredients and all the expense associated with making a cake from scratch. I thought this was a great analogy. And he says that's what composites are in crossbreeding. He says you can get rid of a lot of the work associated with crossbreeding if you can use composites, and you can get hybrid vigor ready-made in a box. And I thought that was a great analogy. And he did that at the Montana Nutrition Conference last spring, and I thought it was great. And I've used that in some programs since then, and I would agree with that. I think that's one way to go. And I think for composites to compete over time, composites are going to have to come up with an acceptable and reliable genetic database that people can draw from. Because if you're just using a composite bull and you don't know what that bull's bringing to the table, you know, you're not going to make very much progress. So in order to compete, they're going to have to come up with a reliable source of genetic information over time. But I think that is one way to go.
I'd like to add, too, that I think one thing that's happening in the industry is we are harvesting these calves quicker than we have. And I think it's continually more that we're harvesting these calves at a younger age. And I'm finding that there's some brain deficits out there. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, brain became a dirty word. But I tell you what, I'm ran into a lot of these commercial cattle that do need some brain. You start feeding these calves a lot quicker. And the last 3 or 4 years, they've been able to overcome it by cheap corn prices. So I think that's one of the main reasons you've got them on board. They go ahead and import to them, still get them into that weight range that they wanted to get into. But I think once we get into high corn prices, cost of gain, there's going to be a real backlash on a lot of these cattle that are coming to feedlots early. And when you kill them 12, 13, 14 months of age, you better have some frame in those cattle, or you're going to have problems. And I think that's going to come to the forefront. And I think frame is one of the things that, and I've talked to several Angus breeders now, that quietly it is becoming more important. So I think that's another avenue you got to look at.
I think one of the things that we could certainly do today is say that if corn stays where it is or goes higher during the next year, we'll just have this program again next year, and it will be a completely different program from what we had this time in terms of the things that we'll be talking about and the things we would be emphasizing, because we'll be talking about more yearling feeding, we'll be talking about those kinds of production systems that have de-emphasized the feed yard rather than re-emphasized the feed yard in terms of days, at least, in the feed yard and some of those kind of things. So obviously that is coming as a major sea change in our business that's going to affect breeding, genetics, and marketing, and heifer development, and so on, as we go through this whole system. And so we'll roll with those punches as they come along. But keep in mind that nothing ever stays the same. About the time you get it all figured out, then it changes and goes sideways on you. So you have to continue to stay alert. As we think about this, and I just throw this out to anybody that wants to comment on it, as we think about producing in alliances, as we think about producing a standardized type of product for retailers and or food service, depending on where they go or even the export markets, as we do that, and we have to make these judgments, we have to make compromises, we have to decide what we can give up and what we want to keep. As we go through all that, and I would like to ask the panel, who do you turn to for information? Where do you go to seek out information? It's one thing to stand up here in front of this crowd and say, well, you need to go find the information and make decisions. Where do you find this? Where do you find the information? Who do you talk to? Who are the people that are your resources, that when you want to investigate something in this particular area, that you call up and talk to or visit with when you're at a meeting? And I just throw that out to the panel and let you respond to it as you'd like to.
I've got a core of people that I really trust out there in the industry, Bill, and the one that's on the carcass side, and I need to know what's going on in the meat side of business. I know Gary Smith, the state of Colorado State, probably use him as much as anything. I'll use cattle feeders that I know, other people in academia, I use you. For a lot to know what's going on, but I think the information is so instantaneous now. Cattle Network, I mean, just throughout the day, a lot of the information I get is coming from there. Russell Cross, Texas A&M, is another person. So they're key people, depending on what segment of the industry you're in, that I'll call and ask their advice.
So it's kind of a personal information network. Sure. You, Ken, I know that. Of course, you deal with Swift every day and back in the industry every day. Who else do you deal with in terms of helping you understand where we're headed and where we're going?
Oh, a lot of different people. I say feed yards that I'm very comfortable with. It's got a track record. A lot of the university people, depending. Purebred breeders. It's just, again, a lot of personal people that you learned over the time that have got the expertise and have got the experience, and they can answer kind of the questions that you need to know all the way from the packing in through the cow calf.
Tom, I would expect a lot of that gets done when you have a meeting with Ranger Renaissance, because you put people from very different backgrounds in that room all at once, and for, you know, we'll shut the door and say, okay, here's what I want to know. Is that where you go to your question.
I got a PhD, and it costs some money to get the PhD. But yes, I learned a lot about the meat side, a lot about the feeding, the feedlot industry. But I want to put in a plug for what happens at NCDA with the Cattle Learning Center, the Cattlemen's College, the network of people. And you hear a speaker, and man, he's got some stuff I'd like to know more about. Well, I can call him and ask him and get into the details. And so I think it's a great networking opportunity right here in our industry, some of the top people in the industry. So to me, this is a very rich resource to tap into to get some of those questions answered.
Now, you beat me to the punch. I was going to say that the hallways out here are probably one of the greatest networking opportunities that cattlemen get in the course of a year, just because of the differences in the flow of people that are up and down these hallways during the course of the day, and the backgrounds and the work experience that they represent, and your opportunity to visit with them and network with them, create relationships that will continue past the meeting, are probably one of the real opportunities that you get when you come to a Cattlemen's College or to an NCBA convention. Patsy, didn't give you an opportunity to jump in on that one.
I would say that a lot of my advisors are sitting right here on this stage. If I have a trace mineral question, for example, John's the person I call. If I've got a vineyard question, if I'm looking for good students to work within our program, Bill, you've known me to call you. But beyond that, and John mentioned earlier that this is very much a relationship business, and I personal relationships and networking is very important. But beyond that, one of my primary sources, one of my primary sources that I look to for information and direction is my customer base, very frankly. Because if you don't have an idea of what your customers are thinking, where they want to go, what are their goals, where are they today, where do they want to be 5 years, 10 years from now, and whether ever all those perceptions are exactly right or not, really doesn't matter, because we're very much in a perception-based business. And if we don't work with those perceptions and work through those, if they aren't necessarily correct, or if they are, one of my best resources, very frankly, are these grassroots guys that are out making it happen every single day on the ranch. And I'm very fortunate to have a group of customers out there that do make their living in the cattle business. And so those people are very, very valuable to me from the standpoint of direction.
One of the things that I do just as a hobby, I end up traveling a lot around the country. And when I travel, if it's at all possible and I've got any spare time, I go to the grocery stores. And I go to stores that I've never heard of or heard the name of or whatever else, but just go in and walk the meat counter and see what's there. And you see first regional differences in the country in terms of the way the counters are set and the way that they use them. You'll see differences in quality. You'll see differences in amount of cooked and pre-cooked and branded and all those sorts of things. And you'll see what brands are obviously making it in those stores and which ones are shrinking down in shelf space and barely able to stay viable. And it's a way to understand kind of where we are in a business that, you know, there's nothing scientific about it, and there's certainly nothing all-inclusive about it, but it's just my way of staying in touch with some of those kind of things and being able to watch over time some of the changes I see. And as you watch that counter, as you think about it, go back 15 years ago. Let's go back to 92, 91, along in there. How many pre-cooked meat products were in the grocery store, period, anywhere? Frozen, not frozen, ready to eat, ready to take home and cook. Swanson's had a Salisbury steak in a TV dinner that was really bad. And that was about the only thing you could find. No, and the chicken was in everything, and pork was coming. And today, I see pork as having made huge strides. in terms of their ready to eat, ready to take home and cook, pre-marinated, pre-set up kind of products. They have done an excellent job, but the place that is the glaring change is in the beef that is available today. You can go in and buy pot roast and meatloaf and just you name it, and you can short ribs and braised ribs and everything that you can take home and throw in a microwave and have ready to go. And the best part of the story is it's good. It really does eat well. It's very satisfactory kind of a product. We got past the old problems that we had with warmed over flavor and some of those issues, and do a lot to check off research that was done in the early years of the check off. But if you watch those kind of growth and you say, okay, now we're talking about ribeye size, and we're talking about the size of a cut, and we're talking about weight of a cut, and you stand there and you look at a shelf full of pot roast that's pre-cooked, and you think about how much variation could those guys stand still and still be able to cook it and get it in these containers. And I don't know the answer to that, but I know it's not very much. And so I know that they have to sort through a lot of them probably to find what they're looking for. Is there a value still in uniformity? Yes. Might it take us down a road to lower production? Could very well do that. Maybe the hybrid, John, is the way that we keep from going down that road. Those are the kinds of issues that are out there in the marketplace today. And they're the kind of things that we have to deal with and you have to think about. And I'm telling you that you go in there and you look at a meat counter and then you make a decision on how to break it out. But it's a way to stay aware of where we are in business. It's a way to just understand what the final consumer really looks at when they walk in and take a look at your product. What I'd like to do now is to open this up to questions. We've got microphones scattered throughout the room here. And if you'd come to the microphone and ask your question so that everybody could hear, it would help us a lot. And then anybody on the panel can react to that question, and we may start a whole other discussion in this particular area. Anybody that would like to ask any questions of the panel up here or any of the things we've talked about today, please come on up to the mics. You can do that whenever the spirit moves. Okay? Steve.
Going back to the terminal versus raising and cooking heifers, could you maybe discuss how the labor might come into that in the future and the lack thereof on many ranches and how going terminal side might help the labor side?
I think labor is one of our limiting factors in the future. It's getting tougher and tougher and tougher to come by. People who have good animal husbandry skills, that's going to be more and more of a challenge as we move through the next 10, 15, 20 years. I think in terms of splitting and doing what you're very good at and terminal production, for example, I think you can do more things and produce more volume with less total labor. I think it will improve overall efficiencies in the cattle industry. The maternal supplier side might take a little additional labor, but I think we have some tools available to us today in terms of computers and a number of different things that can help improve that as well compared to a number of years ago. But I think the overall issue there is to just try to improve overall efficiencies in the cattle industry. And certainly if you're in an area where labor is an issue, terminal production systems may be a way to help you through that problem. I think that's a good point.
There'll be somebody somewhere who spends some long nights cattle dinner with it.
Yeah.
It may not be on every ranch. It may be on selected ranches that were set up for that.
I have a comment about another thing, if we're through with that. One thing we really haven't mentioned, but we tell the cow-calf producers, you need to get data on your calves and find out all about your calves, but how do you get that done? I want to bring up retained ownership, and for the last 4, 5, 6 years, it's been kind of a dirty word for anybody selling these high-priced calves, but I work with a lot of producers of retained ownership, 751 here for a number of years, and they've been very, very successful. So I think a lot of you need to look at this retained ownership or partnering or something, because that's really the only way you're going to get your data back. And then you get a real feel of what your kids do and what the other parts of the market is. And the other thing is, if you're doing retained ownership, when you go out and select for these bulls and stuff, there's a different selection criteria versus a guy that's selling in lean calves and never looking at them again versus a guy that's in a retained program that's going all the way to the grid. And a lot of these cow calf producers that sell them in weaning, you know, where they want a good uniform calf tip, you know, who cares what happens out there? So, and there's money in this retained ownership, so don't get to the point that it's a dirty word, but I think a lot of you really need to look at, especially in the next few years.
Good point, Ken.
As more and more of the product was in the branded programs and alliances and so forth, where do you guys see the price discovery piece of that growing? Right now it seems like the commodity plus premium or so forth. There's more and more of that commodity piece is maybe the lower quality livestock. Does that concern you, and is that school drops, or are we need to find a new way to value these cattle?
Well, again, it's I go back to its relationship business, and in our relationship with Cargill Beef Solutions, it is just that, and that there has to be some trust in the process. You can sit down and work out how we're going to discover what, how that price is going to be determined, but then have to be trusting in the process. And that is in Rancher's Renaissance. Understanding that most of the world doesn't operate that way. And yes, I agree that we do need a good way to discover value in the cattle. If it's in the carcass, how do we really get that information, know what that carcass is worth before you start adding and subtracting the premium? So it is a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I know that I know how we have dealt with it. And it seems to be working successfully, but there's a lot of other issues to have to deal with.
I think that that's always one of the things that comes up, and you know, how do you set the price? And all I would tell you is that with the kinds of marketing programs that exist today, there, and you may find it hard to believe, but there are more ways to set price today than there ever have been in the past. We've got more data on box beef movement and price today than we've ever had before. The translation of box beef price into carcass price, into live price, is something that can be done and is being done every day. Forward contracting by packers through retailers and food service can be translated backwards. There's a whole number of ways to translate price that are not common to us today, but are growing in our industry and will be available to us as we move into these alliance kind of arrangements. And so, you know, in the past we've always depended on, well, what's the carcass price today versus what it was yesterday? And then how did I do against that? And I'm telling you that the answer may get more complicated, but it may get more accurate as we move along in the future as well.
John, let me respond a little bit to that question. That's a great question there. Is ID the answer? Agent source the answer? I'm not sure it is. That's the number one. It's an answer, but it's not the number one answer. Repeat customers come back because the cattle don't get sick. That we don't have morbidity on these calves coming out of Montana and go to the feed yard. And if they have 60% morbidity, they're not coming back. And it seems like everybody knows these calves are hard just because of the gossip mill. But if they're preconditioned, they got their viral IVR, they got a good mineral package behind them. I mean, we've got data to say that just the morbidity rates go down, and those customers, those feed yards come back and want to buy those cattle that they know are not going to get sick. They have a less chance of getting sick.
The other issue is when that morbidity goes down, Ken, the grade goes up. And now we're there in the second time. When you keep those cattle and get sick, those cattle will grade better as they go through the whole system. And that's what you were talking about.
The more innovation, gain, and all that. As far as price goes, as far as I see it, still it's going to be off of a meat price or live price here for a number of years yet, because you know, everybody wants to talk about these new pricing schedules, but every time I get my, and send my data back to these people, all they want to know is how much they better become the average price. You know, I mean, still, that's the benchmark. When you're marketing 30 million head of cattle per year through the industry as a whole, I think that's going to be the benchmark we're going to work off of, and then be pluses and minuses from there.
Bill?
Yeah.
I might address going back to the pull-through effect from the retailer again in terms of price discovery and that kind of thing. I think it's important that the production system, each phase of the production system is allowed to survive, because if any one phase of that production system breaks down due to it being non-profitable, the one who loses the most is the retailer on the end. So I think what you're going to see over the course of time is the retailer will develop a production system where he knows he's got product coming routinely for inventory control purposes, and that's going to have to be on a cost-plus basis, if you will, but within reason. In other words, my cost-plus might be higher than your cost-plus. If that's the case, you're going to win, I'm going to lose. So there's still some market discovery out there, but if we don't build a system here where every phase of the industry can survive, and how many times have we talked this morning about natural production, what it costs versus what the premiums are, that the overall look of that program over the course of time, unless those premiums get bigger, who's going to participate in that 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road? If you've done it once, Tom, are you going to do it again if it hurts you the first time? And it's just a function of who's going to survive and who can do the best job of production in a cost-plus system is kind of where I see it going. That's not going to happen overnight by any stretch of the imagination.
And as I've talked to retailers, what they'll tell me is that they agree wholeheartedly with what Cassie said. They see that coming. And the reason is that in their stores now, they're down to two departments that will generate customer loyalty. They've got a produce department that if that's clean and smells good all the time and it's got a good selection of fruits and vegetables in it, that'll build customer loyalty for them. And that's mainly dependent on the person that they have running that department and how he keeps it looking and how he keeps it arranged and so on. And the other is the meat case. And since pork is largely all today set up ahead of time in terms of being marinated and a lot of it pre-cooked, very little of it in the raw state, chicken is all pre-packaged coming to him. And his competitors can buy all that same chicken and all that same pork. The real place in his meat case that he can spread himself out from somebody else is in the beef section. And so guaranteeing himself the quality of product that he determines that his customers are going to respond to is his major way outside of produce of being able to make customers loyal to him, so that when they say they're going to go get groceries, they don't say, let's go get groceries. They're going to say, let's go down to Kroger's, or let's go down to Albertson's, or let's go down to Safeway. They will say the brand name as opposed to the grocery store name, because that means they've got loyalty to a particular grocer. And that's what makes grocers money, is being able to generate that kind of customer loyalty. And so I think Cassie's dead on this thing. I think that you're going to see the retailers in their own self-interest spend more time getting involved in these things to create the pull-through, to create the place for that volume to go if we're willing to step up and produce it. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. We're talking about cow size and how we fit into the production scheme with big cows and little cows. And I remember lots of conversations with Danny and Ralph Durham over that particular issue, him standing in between a Jersey and a T&E, trying to decide which one of those is more efficient. Thoughts from the panel? Anybody?
That's a difficult question to jump into and answer in a short period of time, but it's all about efficiency of the cow-calf line. Will the cow breed? Do you have the resources to get that cow bred every year in a fairly short period of time and get her reproduced? I wanted to have a genetic. I ran through my feedlot parts information the other day, and my steers and cattle came out in 13 and 12 out of the big barn. And you've got all kinds of formulas to calculate what the cow size ought to be. My philosophy is I care at 2 years of age. I grow her as well as I can to that point, and then she's on her own. And she's going to have to produce every year for 60 days to stay in the herd. I've done that now for 25 years. And I have cattle that will actually defy the body score data that's out there. When they say you have to have a body score of 5, et cetera, to get this level of conception rate, I can beat that every time because the cows are efficient. They never get real big because they produce a calf every year from the time they're 2 years of age. So she's got the genetics to be different. And if she didn't calve and I moved her west to better country than I'm in, the cow weighed 1,400 pounds. But she never gets that big at my place. I don't ever let her. I keep her producing every year. And so I want the genetics to get that 1,300 pound steer with 15 inch eyes, which is what my cow did. But my cull cow weighed 1,000 pounds. Okay? I don't know how to better answer it. In other words, I have a system that makes her produce and stay producing, or she doesn't stay there. And so reproductive performance is really important. And I put the pressure on you, start from day one. But I don't really worry about weighing a bunch of cows and seeing what they weigh, but I know what my cull cows weigh.
So you don't, if the
if she can stay in my system and produce a calf every year, and those calves average 1,300 coming out of the big yard, they gained 3.57 this year, average on nearly 2,000 calves, and that's not really bad. That's a pretty good rate of gain on steer calves. And so I'm happy with that. And so I'm not going to really worry about whether she weaned a 450-pound calf or 550-pound calf at 6.5 months of age, which is when I weaned. I'm not going to fuss and worry about the ratio of cow weight to calf weight. I don't have time to do all that in the first place. So my system is set up to make her produce. If she doesn't, she's out of the system.
I think you made a great point in what I was saying before. See, when you're taking these calves all the way through, weaning weight becomes less and less important. And yet, if you're selling calves and weaning, what's the number one thing you do? Weaning weight. So that's the conflict you got out there. And the other thing is I've seen over years, you know, guys go out and select a replacement heifer. You know, what's the deal? They go out and cut that big top end off every time to keep them. And every year, you know, you got to maybe, if you want a medium to small cow herd, you need to select those heifers. And I just go out and pick the top end with big ones. So.
Bill, I might add to that, in our program in the last 17 years, we've placed about 60,000 heifers in and out of 31 states. That represents a lot of different feed resource environments. But even with that variation in feed resource environment, virtually every heifer that's ever come out of our program is somewhere between a 4.75 frame and a 6.5 frame. Those various cattle will work in different parts of the country. What's the right answer for one person isn't the right answer for another person. I've got a large customer contract that I fill each year right in the Folsom, New Mexico area, year after year after year. That's a pretty tough feed environment. A lot of sagebrush, not a lot of grass. That gentleman wants a 4.75 to a 5.25 frame heifer. That's what he wants, that's what he needs. If I sent those same heifers to some of my Nebraska customers who use a lot of corn stalks and those kinds of things, those cattle aren't right for them. So the key here is getting the right cattle on the right ranch and the right feed resources. A 4.75 will work for the right guy. A 6.5 will work right for the right guy. And it's just a matter of getting those cattle placed correctly. I think that's the biggest key in the whole issue.
John, I can tell you're getting schooled up here.
Oh, yeah, I love this. I'll go the other way on you. What do you do when you go into a ranch and there's a young lady sitting back there who's got 5,000 cows on experiment right now where she's identified, and you got a 1,700 pound cow weaning a 290 pound calf? But you've never used an ID program before. So I think there's several hundred cows went to town off that ranch pretty quick when they realized, you know, I know 50% of what we'd all like to have, but that's like
15%, something like that. I mean, I don't know. We don't, that's not our job, but I think they made the right decision.
But she did like to brag on that account. That was the biggest comment. She makes it be a little trim when they put her across the back. Other questions? Well, we're down to the end of our time. I want to thank you all for your attendance today, and help me thank our panel and our speakers up here.